This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Theory on the ambush. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. On this Tuesday, October 24th, thanks for joining us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
U.S. military officials are nearing a conclusion about how four Army Special Forces soldiers were killed in an ambush in the African country of Niger after a meeting with local elders.
Record-setting heat has descended on Southern California. New marks were established yesterday, and more records could fall today.
Tax reform update. President Trump promising to protect 401k retirement plans, rejecting a proposal to cap contributions.
Game one of the World Series. Astros at Dodgers today. Is baseball prepared to steal fans from the NFL?
So heading into this World Series and looking at all the myriad of issues that are facing the NFL right now, political, injury issues, quality of play, you know, is there an opportunity for baseball to bounce back and steal more of that spotlight?
Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay on baseball's opportunity in the postseason. NBC News is reporting that an emerging theory about the deadly ambush of four Army Special Forces in Niger is that the soldiers were set up by terrorists who were tipped off in advance about a meeting in a village sympathetic to local ISIS affiliates.
Our soldiers are operating in Niger to build the capacity of local forces to defeat violent extremism in West Africa. Their presence is part of a global strategy.
The group of American Green Berets and support soldiers had requested a meeting with elders of a village on October 4th. Such meetings are a routine part of the Green Beret mission. General Joseph Dunford is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
En route to their operating base, the patrol came under attack from approximately 50 enemy using small arms fire, rocket-propelled grenades, and technical vehicles.
Investigators are reportedly leaning toward the conclusion that villagers sought to delay the troops as they tried to leave the meeting with the elders. Once they departed in unarmored vehicles, militants attacked them with small arms and machine gun fire. The threat of nuclear war posed by North Korea has grown to an unprecedented level amid escalating tensions and now requires the U.S., Japan, and South Korea to demonstrate, quote, different responses to the threat. That's the assessment from Japanese Defense Minister Itsunori Onodera as part of a meeting with his U.S. and South Korean counterparts at a meeting of Asian defense chiefs in the Philippines. Reuters says he's urging different responses to meet that level of threat. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis had similar remarks, noting that North Korea's ongoing intimidations threaten regional and global security.
Our security is interconnected, and we speak with a single voice in holding DPRK accountable. And America's commitment to the defense of the Republic of Korea.
Meanwhile, U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff General David Goldfein recently said the military branch there was preparing to place its fleet of nuclear-armed B-52 bombers on 24-hour alert status to remain alert and prepared. Well, all three committees looking into Russian interference in the 2016 election have run into problems, from insufficient staffing to partisan disputes over the scope of their investigations. Any notion that Capitol Hill would reach definitive conclusions on the election meddling appears to be dwindling. New York Times congressional correspondent Nicholas Fandos is here with an update on the probes. Nick, where are we?
So there are three different kind of full-fledged investigations that were going on Capitol Hill related to Russia's election interference and the Trump campaign's potential ties to Russia. So you have the Senate Intelligence Committee, the House Intelligence Committee, and then the Senate Judiciary Committee. All three of these are well-respected bodies with teams of investigators and lawmakers that really know what they're doing. And so, 10 months into the Trump administration, we decided we ought to take a look at where things stand. Now, since the appointment of Bob Mueller as a special prosecutor, there's been a kind of growing expectation that he is going to have the final word on these matters that I'm talking about. Particularly on the House Intelligence Committee, there's been a lot of political infighting in the last several months that suggests that that committee's work is headed for a kind of split partisan report at the end of the day that I will certainly not instill the kind of confidence that I think people are looking to Congress for. The Senate Judiciary Committee, which got its investigation up off the ground most recently, has really not been able to make a lot of progress. There's different reasons for that, but the chief one is the Democrats and Republicans haven't been able to agree on what witnesses to call next, the scope of their inquiry, and things that are basically just essential to get it moving.
On a real surfacey type level, 10 months into the investigation, and we've had no like juicy leaks or anything like that. Is that any kind of indication that there might not be anything of substance when all is said and done?
You know, the thing about reporting this story that's difficult is we don't know for certain. These committees work in secret, and in many cases, a lot of what they're working with is classified information. There have been some leaks pertaining to their work. None of those, as you said, have been particularly salacious thus far, but it's hard to totally count them out or write them off until they're done, I suppose.
We're speaking with New York Times congressional reporter Nick Fandos. He's written a piece entitled "Hopes Dim for Russia Inquiries by Congress as Parties Clash." All right, so you referenced, too, like the committees say they're going to running low on resources at this point. What happens in that case?
Well, essentially what it means in these cases is resources are the number of investigators they have, and is that number up to the task of what they have to pour through? And what that basically means is there are huge reams of data, both from the intelligence community, interviews that they're doing with witnesses, documents that they are requesting, in some cases issuing subpoenas for. All of this stuff is coming in, and you know, if you have a limited number of people to go through them, it takes time. Slows things down. It means you have to make choices about what leads to follow and to what extent. Again, we don't know the full extent of what kind of choices the investigators are making, but I think it's fair to say they're having to make choices.
When is a reasonable time frame here, if there is such a thing, Nick, for, I don't know, wrapping this thing up?
Yeah, well, so each committee will have its own timeline. The Senate Intelligence Committee, which, as we said, is the most serious right now, its chairman has suggested he wants to wrap this up by late spring of 2018, so that would leave time for the states to make any kind of changes they need to make to their electoral systems based on what the committee might find to prevent basically this from happening again. The Senate Judiciary Committee could go on longer than that, or it may end up dead in the water in a few weeks here. We don't quite know. I think the House Intelligence Committee will probably finish first, and one lawmaker, Republican Trey Gowdy, who was famous for chairing the House Benghazi Committee a couple of years ago, he's helping run this probe as well, and he said he's all but given up hope of the committee issuing a bipartisan report. He said even if their conclusions are ultimately the same in private, the Democrats and the Republicans just aren't going to be able to go out and say the same things publicly.
Thanks, Nick. That's Nick Fandos, New York Times congressional correspondent. 14 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for spending time with us on this Tuesday. Heat records are being set across Southern California. Downtown Los Angeles hit 102 degrees yesterday. Long Beach, 105. Burbank, 101. Oxnard, 104. The National Weather Service yesterday issued a red flag warning through tomorrow, saying the high temperatures and Santa Ana winds will bring the most dangerous fire weather conditions that Southwest California has seen in the past few years. Fire Captain Eric Scott.
You have this increased temperature that's been going on for a long time. We have all of our fuels or the brush that's critically dry. And in particular, you get these gusts of wind that can push flames like a freight train.
The LA Times says other cities that set daily records included Riverside, Santa Ana, El Cajon, and Big Bear. Forecasters said that today was also likely to see sweltering conditions that could set new records. Downtown LA and other parts are expected to see triple-digit heat again. Reminder, by the way, the Dodgers-Astros World Series game is set to begin at Dodger Stadium at around 5 p.m. local time, it will be uncomfortably warm. It's 20 minutes after the hour on This Morning. Jennifer Koschenka is here with more of America's First News.
Gordon, President Trump is planning lunch with GOP senators on Capitol Hill as congressional Republicans turn their focus to overhauling the tax code. It'll be Trump's first appearance as president at the Senate Republicans' regular Tuesday policy lunch. It comes as Trump has sparred with GOP senators such as John McCain of Arizona and Bob Corker of Tennessee, as well as with Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Though McConnell and Trump held a joint news conference last week to try to smooth things over, Republicans and the Trump administration say they are determined to get tax legislation into law this year. A nonpartisan federal watchdog says climate change is already costing U.S. taxpayers billions of dollars each year, with those costs expected to rise as devastating storms, floods, wildfires, and droughts become more frequent in the coming decades. A Government Accountability Office report says the federal government has spent more than $350 billion over the last decade on disaster assistance programs and losses from flood and crop insurance. That tally does not include the massive toll from this year's wildfires and three major hurricanes, expected to be among the costliest in the nation's history. Four-time Iditarod champion Dallas Seavey is denying he administered banned drugs to his dogs in this year's race and says he has withdrawn from the 2018 race in protest of the allegation.
I have done nothing wrong. I have never knowingly broken any race rule. I have never given any banned substance to my dogs.
The Iditarod Trail Committee identified Seavey as the musher who had four dogs test positive for a banned opioid pain reliever after finishing the race last March in Nome, Alaska. Talk about creativity. A California surfer has won a recycled surfboard contest with an entry covered with 10,000 cigarette butts. Taylor Lane had the top entry in the Creators and Innovators Upcycle contest by beating out an assortment of boards made from potato sacks, used packaging, and an old bathroom door. Lane and a friend spent the summer plucking butts from the sand, beach parking lots, and local paths in Santa Cruz. The board also uses styrofoam from fish markets. They say it's visually disgusting, but awesome in how gross it is.
He probably didn't come in contact with too many germs, right?
Ugh, could you imagine picking up that stuff? Ooh.
I got a soft spot for Santa Cruz, by the way. I passed through there one time. The University of California, Santa Cruz.
Okay.
Best nickname in America.
I should know this.
The Banana Slugs.
Oh, right. That's awesome.
One of my favorite sweatshirts I ever owned. 23 minutes now after the hour. Thanks for being with us. The newest group of adults about to hit the workforce is known as Generation Z. Their oldest members right now are 21. At 60 million strong, Generation Z is, according to the New York Times, millennials on steroids. What do they mean for our future, especially on the job? Here's Sarah Sladek, author of Talent Generation and CEO of XYZ University. Sarah, who are these folks?
Well, Z is currently between the ages of 8 and 21, and they are not your typical generation of youth. This is the first generation of the 21st century, and they have been entirely shaped by chaos. So in contrast to millennials, who saw a full cycle of boom and bust, Gen Zs have experienced only economic, political, and environmental disruption. And we're finding that this is really shaping them as they move into the workforce and begin to think about careers. They fret much less about typical teen problems than they do about getting a good job and becoming successful. And they're very concerned about the future of the workplace and the future of the world.
Why are they not as concerned with typical teen problems? I thought that was an interesting observation.
Yeah. Well, this is a generation that's never known a time before terrorist attacks or financial crisis. They've been raised during the most disruptive decade in history. So that's taught them that change, real and very significant change, that it's possible, but it's also taught them that the world has many flaws. So they've learned to think like hackers. And they want to think about, how do we fix this? How do we change it? How do we create new solutions, new opportunities? And they're really hoping to find a better way to do things.
We're speaking with Sarah Sladek, author of a book called Talent Generation, How Visionary Organizations Are Redefining Work and Achieving Greater Success. She's also the CEO of XYZ University, and we're talking about Generation Z. So, from a standpoint of, say, a hiring manager, the oldest of these Gen Zers are 21. They'll be out in the workforce, in theory, if they would finish college at the age of 22 or 23. What should hiring managers know about this group?
They should know that this generation is extremely driven, extremely sincere. Because they have been shaped by chaos and disruption, we find that they really have a very serious approach to how they move into work and careers. They put a lot of thought into it. They're very intentional. They literally kind of carry the weight of the world on their shoulders. And they want to get in and make a difference. And they want to work independently. And that's going to be a big shift from what we've gotten used to with millennials, who were so incredibly collaborative.
Thanks, Sarah. Sarah Sladek, author of Talent Generation and CEO of XYZ University. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show, like us on Facebook, or send us an email, thismorning@compassmedianetworks.com.
Thanks for being with us. Welcome into Tuesday, October 24. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka, some of our top stories and headlines. New theory on the deadly ambush of Green Berets in Niger. Japan says the North Korea nuclear threat is at a critical level. Trump says no caps to 401k plans as part of any tax reform. He meets with Senate Republicans for lunch today on the issue. Dodgers-Astros game one of the World Series in L.A. tonight. Eagles beat the Redskins in Monday Night Football. And the cyclist who befriended the driver who left him paralyzed. That story in about 20 minutes. Game one of the World Series tonight as the Astros visit the Dodgers. Can baseball deliver another revival moment? This has become the time of year when we're accustomed to pronouncing baseball's decline, right? Pointing to its shrinking TV ratings and the love of football. But football's been wilting under the spotlight lately with its own audience issues. Could baseball seize the opportunity? It's a story from Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. Jason, how do you see it?
You know, for the last, I don't know, couple of decades, it seems that we've all been in agreement that baseball is on the wane and football is king, right? That football is just the dominant sport in this country. It dominates the television ratings, and baseball should be so lucky as to sniff what's a top 20 rating for football. But last year we saw a spectacular World Series with the Cubs and the Indians and, of course, you know, a streak on the line there and some incredible numbers. Game 7 of the World Series last year, 40 million people watched, which is a crazy number for baseball. And so heading into this World Series and looking at all the myriad of issues that are facing the NFL right now, political, injury issues, quality of play, you know, is there an opportunity for baseball to bounce back and steal more of that spotlight? Now, I don't doubt for a second that every television executive in the universe would have preferred the Yankees to make the World Series over the Houston Astros. But, you know, Houston's a terrific team, won 101 ball games this year. The first time two 100-win teams have met in the World Series since 1970.
Wow.
It's a high-quality matchup, and will be interesting to see. I mean, look, it's not going to somehow eclipse the Super Bowl rating or anything like that or anything close, but there's an opportunity for another sport to go in there and grab a little bit of mind share.
Too late, too slow, too long. That's been my complaint for a long time. Does that matter when you have two really quality teams like this?
I think it absolutely matters, and I think it would be wise with baseball to, you know, tinker with the product more. I think baseball is a sport that thrives on tradition. There's a lot of you know, comparison that's done generation to generation, and I think they've been probably too protective of sort of the traditions of the game and get in there and under the hood and make adjustments, speed up pace of play. You're right, you know, the Kings, you know, especially when you're talking about first pitches that go off, you know, after 8 o'clock and games that end after 11, 11:30, sometimes midnight, you know, that's just too much of an ask on somebody when you're talking about a seven-game series. So I think baseball can't afford to just, you know, hope for big market teams to bail it out in its product. They need to keep messing around with it a little bit. And I think this is an opportunity for baseball to, you know, continue to get underneath the hood, make adjustments, accelerate things. You know, Gordon, I'm on the record of saying I like seven-inning games on weeknights. That's a little bit of a radical idea, but I think it can catch hold. What do you think?
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. He's written a piece entitled, "As NFL Wobbles, Is This Baseball's Time?" What I think is I want to see the hate mail that started to fill up your inbox after calling for a seven-inning game during the week.
You know, it's funny you should say that, and I'll be totally candid with you. I mean, there were some people who were like, absolutely don't mess with baseball, you know, get out of our sport. But I was surprised with the number of people who, you know, if they weren't supportive of necessarily that idea, did feel that baseball needed to make some, you know, significant alterations to pace of play because it is a problem. You know, you think about how your attention wanes when you're watching it at home on television, but this is even true of the live product. You know, people are leaving games early. You go to a Yankee game in the middle of the season on a Tuesday night, you know, you look down at the stadium in the sixth inning, if it's a long game, people are walking out. Mm-hmm. And that's not great. And I don't think there's any reason why we need to be so protective of these traditions to the degree that we don't do anything.
And are you comfortable with this new format in which two National League teams compete for the World Series?
yeah, you know, it is funny that people, there is a sort of a small quadrant of the internet that seems to feel like this is somehow a sacrilegious World Series because the Astros were in the National League up until 2013. I don't feel the same way. You know, you have to win where you are, and, you know, the Astros took on and beat all comers. They beat the class of the American League to get there. I don't think this is somehow an illegitimate World Series club. They're terrific.
Thanks, Jason. Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. It's 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Reminder, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username @ThisMorningShow. If you like some cynicism and sarcasm, you can follow me directly on Twitter @GordonDeal. Tuesday, welcome aboard. Beyond the headlines now, this morning's Mike Gavin is here with a look at some of the other stories you'll be talking about this morning.
Good morning. Well, if you do a lot of shopping on Amazon, you're bound to occasionally get something you didn't want in your order. Maybe you accidentally bought the wrong size or quantity, or something was shipped to you by mistake. Now it looks like there's a drug dealer out there somewhere about to give an Amazon customer service rep a piece of his mind after the online shipping giant unwittingly delivered 65 pounds of marijuana to an unsuspecting Florida couple.
Jeez.
That's a lot. According to the New York Post, the woman and her fiancé, who had actually ordered empty plastic storage bins, said they knew something was amiss before they even opened up the delivery, given how heavy the boxes were. The package was shipped via UPS from Massachusetts by Amazon's Warehouse Deals and filled the couple's Orlando home with the smell of pot as soon as it was open. The 27-gallon storage bins were inside, but they were packed with wrapped bundles of marijuana. They immediately called the cops and were fearful that the owners of that considerable package of pot might come looking for it. Both Amazon and Orlando police are looking into it, and no arrests have yet been made.
Mm. See, that would be that would fall into the like neighborhood Facebook group that I have where I live, where for whatever reason deliveries always go to the wrong house. So people post on Facebook, hey, I was looking for something from Amazon today. It says it was delivered. Does anybody have it? This would be an interesting one.
Right.
My 65 pounds of marijuana were apparently delivered, but not to my house. Does anybody have it?
Right. Or, you know, we know about that trend about the, you know, packages being stolen off of people's porches.
Yeah.
Or this one gets delivered, then it gets stolen.
Who stole my pot?
That person opens it up, they're probably pretty happy about that because they're a criminal. So,
Whenever I'm doing a drug deal that involves more than 50 pounds of a drug
drug, whether it's pot or coke or whatever. I just prefer to deliver it myself.
Yeah, I mean, that's just common sense.
I take the guesswork out. Right?
That's
just deliver it yourself.
That's smart thinking on your part.
Thank you.
And Halloween is around the corner, but even so, it was a little strange for some to see Arizona Cardinals quarterback Drew Stanton running around the field before Sunday's game in a Supergirl costume. Though it's not the first time he's had to dress up in unconventional workout gear with past costumes, including an American flag unitard and the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Former Cardinals backup Matt Barkley was once seen donning a half shirt and Speedo for on-field drills. So what gives? According to ESPN, there's a weekly skills challenge among the Cardinals quarterbacks, and unfortunately for Stanton, he lost last week, leading to the Supergirl outfit. Carson Palmer brought this game over from his days with the Cincinnati Bengals, but it's really taken off this season after Palmer started posting pics of the losers on Instagram. Now Stanton is going to need more than just a super costume to help him navigate the next 8 weeks of the NFL season as the Cardinals starter after Palmer broke his arm during Sunday's loss to the Rams.
Yeah.
But the good news is he'll probably win the skills challenge because Palmer's got a broken arm now.
Right.
So there's a silver lining to this that he might not have to run around in a Supergirl outfit again.
I guess as long as they keep winning, I'm comfortable with this.
Yeah.
But that strikes me as like a Sunday morning pregame distraction.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I would want my players doing that. I mean, as funny as it is, good-natured and all that stuff.
Well, they did lose 33-0 after this happened, and Palmer broke his arm.
That's right.
Maybe not for a little while.
I'm calling a team meeting this morning. This practice is over. Thank you, Mike. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Morning, America's First News. Finding a house to buy these days is only a little easier than finding a needle in a haystack. Existing home sales rose modestly last month despite the hurricanes in the Houston area and Florida, but the National Association of Realtors says space was still 1.5% below the year-ago level. The chief culprit is a national housing supply that remains at a 20-year low of just 4.2 months. That's the time it would take to run out of homes for sale if no new units were added. Lawrence Yoon, chief economist of the Realtors Group, tells USA Today he expects supplies to stay low for at least the next year. Here's why he says house hunting will be more challenging and why prices will rise. First, home building has been hindered by shortages of construction workers and available lots. Second, real estate investors keep renting, unwilling to sell their properties. Number three, capital gains taxes on pricier homes. And number four, rising borrowing costs. The Federal Reserve has indicated it likely will raise its key short-term interest rate a third time this year. It's 8 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning. Jennifer Koshenka is back with more of America's First News.
Gordon, the U.S. Special Forces unit ambushed by Islamic militants in Niger didn't call for help until an hour into their first contact with the enemy. So says Joseph Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as he tried to clear up some of the murky details of the assault that killed four U.S. troops and has triggered a political brawl.
It was planned as a reconnaissance mission. What happened after they began to execute it? In other words, did the mission change? That is one of the questions that's being asked. It's a fair question.
Dunford says the fallen soldiers' families deserve answers about the deadly ambush in the West African nation, but right now details are lacking. President Trump's criticism of Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl has become a factor in the soldier's sentencing as a military judge weighs the president's impact on public perception of military justice. The judge deciding Bergdahl's punishment for walking off his post in Afghanistan in 2009 heard defense arguments yesterday that Trump recently reaffirmed his scathing criticism and is preventing a fair sentencing hearing. Bergdahl faces a maximum sentence of life in prison after pleading guilty last week to desertion and misbehavior before the enemy. Broiling heat is breaking temperature records across Southern California. The mercury soared yesterday as high pressure dominated the region, spawning dry and gusty Santa Ana winds that raised fire danger. Residents can't take it.
I feel like every fall I think, how could it be so hot? And I think, wait a minute, is this hot last year?
And downtown Los Angeles reached 102 degrees yesterday, breaking the record of 98 for the date. The temperature forecast for the start of the World Series in Los Angeles this evening, 94 degrees. Well, it must be nice to be so wanted. Amazon says it received 238 proposals from cities and regions hoping to be the home of the company's second headquarters. The online retailer kicked off his hunt for a second headquarters in September, promising to bring 50,000 new jobs. Proposals from cities, states, and regions were due last week, and Amazon made clear that tax breaks and grants would be a big deciding factor on where it chooses to land. It will announce a decision next year.
It's got a lot of sway. doesn't it? You're bringing
238.
You're bringing $5 billion worth of construction and 50,000 jobs, mm-hmm. man. Woo. Thank you, Jen. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. A guy named David Platalero was riding his bike to class at the Blackbird Academy Music School in Nashville, Tennessee, when he got into a terrible accident that would change his life a year and a half ago. CBS News says the driver ran a red light and crashed into the then 24-year-old. He suffered a spinal cord injury. For 10 days, he lay in a hospital bed thinking about his injuries, but he was also worried about the woman who hit him. He wanted to get in touch with her to forgive her. 5 months later, 23-year-old Freya Markowski, the driver, sent him a text saying she lost her soul after the accident and that she cried for him every day. Platalero replied with a video of himself walking with braces and a harness. The pair kept in touch, texting or video chatting at least once a month. Last spring, nearly a year after the accident, the two decided to meet at a local coffee shop. Platalero stepped out of a car in crutches. He recently moved to L.A., by the way, to pursue a music career. He's getting married next year and has invited Ms. Markowski as a guest. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.